of journalism is to question the prevailing wisdom. Question the prevailing wisdom.
Just a second. Just speak the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
All rights reserved and affirmed.
Free of all minds. These are weapons of mass descent.
These are weapons of mass descent.
Welcome to Uprising, a daily digest of independent news analysis, investigation, education, artistic expression, and activism. It's Wednesday, September 1st, 2010, and I'm your host, Sonali Kohatkar.
It just makes me stop and think.
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 Silence is not an option.
How BP managed to cover up the worst of the oil spill in the Gulf Coast. Gustavo Arellano on how the New York Times got Orange County laughably, stupidly wrong, and Pornland, how porn has hijacked our sexuality, plus the right hook.
But I can't help myself, why should I?
This is Uprising.
Good morning and welcome to Uprising. Aspects of the BP oil spill continue to make news. This week, it was reported that some Gulf residents began receiving emergency payments for loss of income, but over 90% of all claims files were rejected for lack of proper documentation. The Gulf Coast is currently under a hurricane warning, and until the storm passes, BP will not be able to continue its efforts to replace the blowout preventer on its Deepwater Horizon rig. However, media coverage of the environmental damage is vanishing at about the same rate as the visibility of the oil on Gulf Coast beaches and the water surface. The nightly news is no longer filled with images of oil-soaked birds and dolphin carcasses, and there have been headlines proclaiming that the oil has effectively disappeared. But these assessments simply reflect a shallow comprehension of the nature of oil, ecosystems, and the use of massive amounts of chemical dispersants. The most recent edition of Mother Jones magazine details the many ways BP's oil will wreak havoc on the entire marine ecosystem for decades and how the company has managed to limit its liability. My guest is Julia Witte. She's a writer and reporter, and she's one of those whose cover articles in the latest Mother Jones has just been published under the title The BP Cover-Up. Welcome to Uprising, Julia.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you very much for joining us. Now, before we get into some of the details of how BP has managed to limit its liability, give our listeners a sense of how the ocean itself should be understood, a simple breakdown, if you will, of the layers of life that there are underwater.
Well, in this article, at the time that the explosion happened out there in the Gulf, I was actually working on an article looking at the deep ocean life. And there's a tremendously rich community of life. In fact, it's the richest community of life on Earth that lives in the open water column. It doesn't live on the seafloor and it doesn't live at the surface. And yet it really feeds most of the life that we know and love of the ocean that inhabits the surface. Birds, a lot of the marine mammals, many of the turtles, things like that. So there's this tremendously rich community of life known as the deep scattering layer. It's an archaic term based on how it first showed up in echo sounders of early oceanographers. But it's a migratory community of life that basically spends the daytime hours below darkness and migrates with darkness up towards the surface. And it's this huge twice-daily vertical migration, and most of the life that we know from the land actually makes its living diving down to feed on the creatures of the deep scattering layer. It's everything from fish to squid and lots of invertebrates.
And how much do we know about this ecosystem, this living ecosystem? Are marine biologists still discovering new things about it?
Oh, completely. We know really very little about it, and it's just beginning to be studied because obviously it's a tremendous challenge. It lives in the darkness. The entire community lives below the cusp of perpetual darkness. So we're just now developing the technology, and ironically, a lot of the technology that we're using to study the creatures of the deep scattering layer actually come from oil and gas drilling industries offshore as well as the military. But those tools are now being adapted by science to study what's really going on with this tremendous community that really feeds the entire ocean.
What do you mean by feeds the entire ocean? How are the how is the health of the various creatures we find in this layer connected to even the health of humans?
Well, obviously, anything that would be impacting that huge biomass of life, the deep scattering layer, is going to be fed upon by the marine mammals, the whales and dolphins and seals who are diving down into it, the seabirds who are feeding on it. Many of the predatory fish that we eat from the ocean make their living diving down and feeding or just feeding at night. But most of what we know actually are nocturnal feeders that wait for this great biomass to rise up to the surface. Obviously, in the Gulf of Mexico, if those animals have been contaminated by the oil and gas and dispersants, then they're going to be contaminating the animals that are feeding on them, the surface animals that we know.
So would you say that this catastrophic oil spill has, in essence, decimated the entire fishing industry in the Gulf Coast?
I don't think we know enough yet to know whether it's decimated it. I do know that the scientists I've spoken with have said that this is going to be the subject of their study for the rest of their lives, regardless of where their topic of interest had been. This has derailed it. Everyone has to focus on this now to figure out what are going to be the long-term impacts of massive amounts of oil, gas, and chemical dispersant being added in a most unnatural way, and that was being added at depths, never before done. And I can talk more about that if you want.
Well, let's talk about the use of the chemical dispersant. The oil spill itself was one major disaster. Would you characterize the massive and unprecedented use of chemical dispersant, this particular chemical called Corexit, as, in essence, another catastrophic spill?
I would. I would say that, and that's even worse. It's worse than just having allowed the oil and the gas, really, to come out of the well and float very quickly to the surface, which they likely would have done, where if they'd really put any effort into it, BP could have, seriously skimmed and scooped up all that stuff. Instead, they injected, just tons and tons of this chemical dispersant right in at the wellhead, and they dispersed the oil into very fine droplets, really a cloud of oil that became more neutrally buoyant. It was no longer going to float to the surface. And in fact, it's been found in huge underwater plumes, which your listeners have probably heard quite a lot about. Those may just travel around in there. To some extent, they may be becoming degraded by microbes that actually feed on those things, like oil and gas, but nobody knows of microbes that feed on dispersant. So now we have what was a source point of solution from one wellhead coming quickly to the surface where it could have been skimmed. We now have this very diffuse sort of pollution. Went from a 2D pollution to a 3D pollution model, and it will never be recoverable, this oil.
So
it will also never be seen. That's the important part.
So in retrospect, from the perspective of an environmentalist and someone who cared about cleaning up the Gulf Coast, was it a bad idea to use the dispersant at all? And should BP have simply allowed the oil to float onto the surface where it would have been visible and use booms and other mechanical methods to clean it up? That would have been the better way?
Yeah, it would have been the better way, especially in light of the fact that we didn't know what was in that dispersant. We don't know what the chemical makeup of it was. Our laws did not require the formulators to even release the formula. We don't have any long-term toxicity studies on what that stuff does in the ocean. So here we've added a whole new level of pollutant that's interacting with oil and gas in ways we don't understand. Why would we take a polluted environment where we've had a man-made cause of pollution and suddenly add yet another pollutant into it? No sense at all.
So in a way, did BP's use of the chemical dispersant cancel out the work that the booms were doing trying to skim off the oil?
Absolutely. I mean, it makes no sense. They had one approach. We're going to contain it and corral it and collect it. That's what they would have done with the booms. And then we're going to disperse it. Well, which one is it? You can't have both going on. So the two really counteracted each other and led probably to less of anything happening. I mean, the real truth of what is going to fix the pollution in the Gulf of Mexico are the microbes working within nature, and that takes time. That literally takes time, and now it's been made more difficult, as I said, because we have chemicals that the microbial community of the Gulf of Mexico has never encountered and are not used to, and may, in fact, be lethal to them.
I'm speaking with Julia Whitty. Her article, BP's Deep Secrets, can be read in the latest issue of Mother Jones magazine. So, essentially, BP did a big favor to itself by using chemical dispersants, because the most important thing it did was hide the oil. The oil is now basically been dispersed under the surface of the water. It can't be easily seen. The news media doesn't have photographs that are dramatic to take anymore from outside, from the off of the surface of the water. And so by the use of this chemical core exit, this dispersant, BP has essentially managed to limit its liability?
That's right. I mean, that's the really most horrible reality of it, is that, you know, at some point along the line, I'm sure they said, we don't want another Exxon Valdez. We don't want tons of this goopy oil washing ashore and killing the breeding seabirds, which were underway at that point. And what could we do? Well, we could hit it all at the wellhead so it never comes up to the surface. We never actually see, you know, those 252 million gallons of oil and and natural gas that we're still, we only see a tiny tip of it. And so I think it was a very calculated risk, knowing that the laws that were enacted post Exxon Valdez, that BP would be held liable with fines of between $1,000 a barrel spilled and $4,300 of fines per barrel spilled. And they, if they dispersed it at the wellhead, obviously, who's going to ever say how much they actually spilled?
What about other types of chemicals that have contaminated the water there, aside from the oil itself and the core exit? You write about some of these drilling fluids, which I'd never really heard about, that contain arsenic and lead and all sorts of other poisonous chemicals. Do we have to worry about that, too?
Yeah, I mean, that's a normal part, sadly, of offshore drilling, is that these drilling muds, it's kind of a euphemism for this heavy metals, really, in a way, it's clays and things that are loaded with heavy metals that are used to actually keep this extremely buoyant, you know, gas and oil, push it down in the reservoir below this sort of drillable cap of the drilling muds. Now, BP not only was, you know, using that in the course of their drilling, but they've been pouring an awful lot more at it ever since they were trying to plug it. So they added 30,000 barrels in their failed top kill. And they'll continue to add more now in this final stage as they attempt to complete the relief well. That will also, there will be more drilling muds. The EPA has done studies around these wellheads in the Gulf of Mexico, of which, by the way, there are 50,000 holes punched into the floor of the Gulf of Mexico for all the wellheads. And they found that that particular toxic brew within the drilling muds probably will be toxic to life on the seafloor for up to 40 years.
Now, there are also tens of thousands of abandoned wells in the Gulf Coast. BP, from reading your article, has abandoned 600 of them. What do these abandoned wells mean for the health of the Gulf Coast?
Well, it's, you know, since this disaster, there's been a look at what is the status of these abandoned wells. They've been plugged, but how well are they plugged? And in fact, no one ever monitors them. And I believe there's 27,000 plugged and largely unmonitored wells, these old holes punched into the floor of the Gulf of Mexico. We do know that after, for instance, the passage of Hurricane Katrina, between, you know, plugged wells and the 33,000 miles of pipeline that lies below the surface of the Gulf of Mexico, that nearly an entire Exxon Valdez's worth of oil was spilled just from the passage of Hurricane Katrina itself. So this entire infrastructure that's built supporting this fossil fuel industry, this dirty energy industry, is in itself incredibly vulnerable to the natural cycles that go on in the Gulf of Mexico, the passage of cyclonic tropical storms.
I want to turn back to the ecosystem and get a little bit more in depth. You write about it quite a bit in your article in Mother Jones, and you write in particular about species of sea turtles, sperm whales, and manatees. How precarious are some of these species that I think were already at risk before? What is their situation, and will the Gulf Coast oil spill push them over the edge toward extinction?
I think some of these species are going to be very challenged by what happened this summer and what's going to continue to go on in one form or another. We have so many species tottering on the edge. I mean, the Gulf of Mexico sperm whale population is estimated at about 1,600 individuals and feeding heavily around the area of the Deepwater Horizon wellhead. We have critically endangered western bluefin tuna, who we knew were spawning in the waters right around the wellhead at the time of the explosion. We have Kemp's Ridley sea turtles, the most endangered turtle on Earth, which is breeding only in beaches along Gulf coasts. So we have the brown pelican, who just come off the endangered species list. So we have so many animals that are just barely hanging on down there. And this is sadly what happens with critically endangered species, is that it takes one assault then to just knock them out, maybe forever. And that's the fear with what might happen as a result of this episode in the Gulf of Mexico.
One of the really interesting things that your writing revealed is the research being done on tube worms that are hundreds of years old. Tell us about these tube worms and how new is the research on them?
Well, these are animals that live actually making their living off naturally occurring seeps of methane from the seafloor in the Gulf of Mexico. And these are unusual communities of life that are known in science as extremophile life, because they can survive in conditions that we couldn't. And these cold methane seep communities, as they're known, were first found in the Gulf of Mexico only, I think, in 1984. Hmm. And since then, many more have been found. And they turn out to be home to unusually long-lived animals, which is what we find anyway in the ocean, that the ocean is conducive to long life. So we actually have worms that may live 500 or 600 years.
500 or 600 years. And now this entire ecosystem we've been discussing is in extreme danger because of this oil spill and the dispersant that has been used, as well as some of these other very dangerous drilling fluids. Now, you mentioned methane. How does that contribute to the long-term negative effects on wildlife in the Gulf Coast?
Well, obviously, there was a tremendous amount of methane, and what got very little attention was as much as 40% of what spewed from this wellhead was methane or natural gas. And what has that done? Well, in fact, the science that's been looked at so far in this finds that possibly because of the dispersant, but nobody knows why, very little of that gas appeared to have shot up to the surface and released into the atmosphere. And as I said in my article, well, that's good news for us because that's a greenhouse gas. But it's probably bad news for the ocean. And in fact, David Valentine, whose work I cited, was down there fairly recently and found natural gas dissolved at 100,000 times normal background rates to depths of 2,500 feet. Mm-hmm. So these plumes are not just oil plumes, they're also gas plumes. And yes, there are animals that are adapted in the Gulf of Mexico to feed on that natural gas, but what we're seeing, in fact, is we're having blooms of these animals that are using up all the available oxygen in the water, and now we're having offshore dead zones in the Gulf of Mexico. So that's a problem already in the Gulf of Mexico from another source, but now we're increasing the area of dead zone, which is low oxygen water, no place for most of the life we know to live in. It'll either kill them or they'll have to leave those waters.
Well, Julia Witte, I want to thank you so much for shedding some much-needed light on what's happening beneath the surface, if you will, in the Gulf Coast, and how BP has managed to limit its liability. And we'll, of course, continue to follow up on this story in terms of what the government is or isn't doing later in our program and on this show. Julia Witte, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me on.
Julia Witte is a writer and reporter whose cover article in the latest Mother Jones magazine is called "The BP's Deep Secrets." And we'll link to her article from our website later today at uprisingradio.org. You can also check out the latest issue of Mother Jones. This is Uprising. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, Gustavo Arellano on Orange County and its changing demographics and how the New York Times got it all wrong. Also, this week's edition of The Right Hook, and then Gail Dines will join us in studio to discuss her new book, Pornland, How Porn Has Hijacked Our Sexuality. Stay tuned.
I'm Cornel West, and you're listening to Uprising with Sister Sonali Kolhatkar on KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles and 98.7 FM Santa Barbara.
Hi, I'm KP Solomon, KPFK Peace Award winner and star of Speak of Me As I Am, a one-man musical tribute to Paul Robeson. Speak of Me As I Am will be playing at the Barnsdall Gallery Theater, opening on Friday, August 6th, and continuing through Sunday, September 5th. In my performance, I become Paul Robeson, 20th century Renaissance man who refused to remain silent about the economic and racial inequalities in the world. The show brings to light Paul Robeson's politics and reflects upon the price he paid for speaking out. That's Speak of Me as I Am at the Barnsdall Gallery Theater in Hollywood, August 6th through September 5th. More details available at the KPFK website or by calling 323-960-5772. That's 323-960-5772. KPFK is a proud media sponsor.
This is Uprising. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. Orange County, California has always been known nationally for its conservative politics, conjuring up images of wealthy white suburban enclaves that faithfully churn out voters for the Republican Party. But it's also always been a city of immigrants who have largely been invisible to the national media. Now, that burgeoning immigrant population has grown enough to turn the county's white population into a minority, and in particular, turning the county into a minority Republican district. In 2008, 48% of OC voters picked Barack Obama for president. Immigrants aren't automatically Democrats. In particular, Vietnamese and many Latinos often vote Republican. But the number of independent voters in OC has also increased to the point that this past June, the registered Republicans, according to the New York Times, dropped to 43%, which is the lowest number in 70 years. Adam Nagorny's August 30th piece in the Times, titled Orange County is No Longer Nixon Country, cites that 95% of OC's public school students are Latino. He also quotes Irvine's first Korean American mayor, Soo Ki Kang, as boasting of having 35 languages spoken in our city. Commenting regularly on the changing demographics of Orange County is the popular OC Weekly columnist of Ask a Mexican, author and walking encyclopedia, Gustavo Arellano, soon to be managing editor at the OC Weekly. His latest blog post is called New York Times Gets Orange County Laughably Stupidly Wrong. Welcome to Uprising, Gustavo.
Hola, Sonali.
Thanks so much for joining us. All right, so what did the New York Times get wrong?
The entire premise of their piece, the reporter suggests that just because that the Republican Party has hit a historic low in registering people, that somehow that means that there's this massive sea change or title change in Orange County, that somehow we're becoming a more liberal county and somehow that's okay. But the problem is that it's not true, especially as somebody who's lived in this county his entire life, who reports on the county for a living and tracks the county. It's a lie. Just because the Republican Party has fewer people enrolled doesn't mean that somehow we have less conservatives. And what struck me the most about the piece is that Nagorny only had one throwaway line saying, oh yeah, and you know, there's anti-immigrant resolutions, or there might be anti-immigrant sentiment, but that's the county religion in Orange County. We're still the place that just a couple of years ago had the Minutemen Party, or the Minutemen movement born here. Voters in Costa Mesa are probably going to elect somebody that's directly tied to hate groups as a state assembly member, and that's somehow supposed to be progress, or that's somehow supposed to tell us that Orange County has changed. It hasn't changed one bit, and if anything, I do think it's getting worse in some ways right now.
So the fact that the number of registered Republicans has dropped, could that simply mean that there are conservative independent voters that don't necessarily want to be affiliated with the Republican Party but are still going to vote conservatively and likely vote for Republicans?
Absolutely. Another line that I criticized, Nagorny at one point said, and some officials claim that the Democrats are probably going to sweep the Republicans out of office. It's very telling that Nagorny doesn't tell us who these quote-unquote some officials are, because the only people that buy into that fantasy world is the Democratic Party of Orange County. And if you look at the races, if you look at the partisan races, in other words, state assembly, state senate, Congress, those are the main three. The only Democrats that ever have a chance of getting voted in are those in the heavily Latino cities of Anaheim and Santa Ana, with parts of Garden Grove and Westminster thrown in. They call it the Democratic donut, this area of liberal of Democratic parties. And the only reason, though, that the Latinos vote Democrats is because there's no way on earth any lucid Latino in Orange County would ever vote for a Republican, given their longstanding anti-Mexican sentiment here in the county. So the Democrats, they don't have a chance in any other election, no matter how much they try to believe themselves. Somebody pointed out to me that the Democratic Party used to have a control of Orange County back in the 70s, which was true, but all of those officials end up going to jail on various corruption charges. For Nagorny to say that somehow we're going to get more Democrats in office in partisan races, it's just not going to happen, not for the next decade or so.
Well, what about the fact that Orange County's immigrant population has burgeoned? How does that fit within the OC conservative context?
Oh, that's an old story. We could have told that story a decade ago, if not 15 years ago, if not 20 years ago. I always find it funny how the New York Times is usually a decade late to the story and then all of a sudden pronounces it. And of course, because the Times still has that cachet, everyone says, oh, well, if the New York Times says it, it must be true now. How do the immigrants play into that narrative? It's the same thing. I would even say that most of the immigrants that do come in to Orange County, they do tend to go for the Republican Party. Vietnamese, of course, are the most the classic example of that. People that vote automatically Republican just because of a perceived sense that Republicans are anti-communist and Democrats are pro-communist, if that makes any sense. But a lot of the other groups, they've also usually gone with the Republican Party. The Arab American community, until recently, now things are changing. That's going to be an interesting story. They've usually gone with the Republican Party. Same thing with...
And in fact, the Arab American community came out heavily for Bush in the 2000 election.
Exactly.
Not so much in the 2004 election.
But that changed because, that's changing, obviously, 2004 election. And then here, of course, with the Republican Party basically painting all Arabs and Muslims as Manchurian terrorists, they're not going to go for the Republican Party in that aspect. And then some of the other immigrant groups, they don't really vote in traditional numbers for the Democratic Party as the Latinos do. And the city that Adam pointed out as being like this paragon of immigrants coming into Orange County and becoming successful and becoming liberalized, the city of Irvine, Irvine is one of the most regressive cities in the county. That is a very diverse city, and in that sense, it's fine. But they get the types of immigrants that Orange County want: middle class, largely apolitical, and NIMBYers. If you are not of the right profile in Irvine, I guarantee you, within 5 minutes, if you're walking down the sidewalks, the police will stop you and ask you questions.
I'm speaking with Gustavo Arellano, soon to be managing editor at OC Weekly. And of course, he's the popular columnist of Ask a Mexican. And he has recently blogged about the New York Times' piece called Orange County is No Longer Nixon Country. He says the New York Times got Orange County laughably, stupidly wrong. So basically, what about the fact that and this is certainly true anywhere, not just in Orange County, but the fact that older, wealthier, established whites tend to vote in higher rates than, for example, new immigrants or young people.
And that's the other thing that Nagorny doesn't talk about. Sure, we have a lot of Latinos, but we also have a large undocumented community that still doesn't have the access to be able to vote. Most of the people who do vote in elections, as you state, are just, I would say, just older people in general, therefore leaving out the needs of the younger community out there. That's why you have some school districts that are constantly itching for money, because the property taxes of the cities, they're falling down as almost all revenues for city coffers right now. And the older voters, they don't want to vote for a school district that has kids that do not look like them. That's Santa Ana Unified's the one that's 95% Latino, not all of Orange County. But the older voters from a previous generation, they don't care about the kids. They only care about their kids, and their kids are long gone from here.
Or in private school.
Exactly. What you are having is an inequity or an imbalance, really, between the haves and the have-nots, and it's played out in the political sphere. But again, the Democratic Party here in Orange County, for a long time, they wouldn't stand by undocumented college students who were trying to, get Loretta Sanchez, a congresswoman from Santana, to co-sponsor the DREAM Act. And it's a party that itself is horribly out of tune with what's going on the street. There are some young activists in the Democratic Party who are trying to push it, but I would argue they're not doing enough.
Now, finally, Gustavo, even though the author of this article may not have intended it this way, but do you think that the way the article is presented serves to feed a growing fear among conservative whites in the United States of being edged out by a, you know, horde of people of color who are, you know, liberals and et cetera?
Oh, you know what? I want them to have that fear. Thank God that they are getting scared. Because it's demographic reality. It's the truth. And as I've argued so many times in my columns, in my writings, it really is a lot of nothing. Anybody who's scared that the fact that, you know, that white folks are a minority now in Orange County, I think they're 48% of the whole population, they deserve to be scared because they're fools. And frankly, they don't have any faith whatsoever in that very country which they profess to be protecting its ideals of. Meanwhile, us, the immigrants, the children of immigrants, we're going along, you know, life just, you know, just like the previous generation, some struggles, some accomplishments, but always moving forward. And if they don't want that land, hey, we'll take care of it and we'll make it even better and we'll make it less racist than how they had it for so many decades.
Well, Gustavo, finally, congratulations on being offered a managing editor position at OC Weekly. What's, very briefly, what's in store for you in the future?
A lot of work on the desk. I still don't have my priorities. Thank you, though, for that. Honestly, it's just the same thing. I just want to help out the paper the same and continue to make it the best paper in Orange County, one of the best papers in Southern California. I look forward to working with my colleagues and just, as I say, more of the same, more of the same.
Gustavo Arellano, as always, thanks so much for joining us.
Gracias.
Gustavo Arellano has been my guest, and you can read all his writings at ocweekly.com. We'll also link to his blogs and his column from our website, uprisingradio.org, later today. This is Uprising. After this week's edition of The Right Hook, we'll hear from Gail Dines, a professor of sociology and women's studies, about her new book, Pornland, How Porn Has Hijacked Our Sexuality. Stay tuned.
Welcome to The Right Hook, a weekly segment which covers the machinations of the right wing, from the Republican Party to the Tea Party Patriots and beyond. I'm Chris Bennett. Given the large amount of Fox and other news coverage of Glenn Beck's honor rally, it's likely you didn't miss this news story. Addressing fewer than 100,000 conservatives, Beck did not attack President Obama or race-bait African Americans as some expected. Instead, he slathered the Constitution, the Founding Fathers, and the military with God talk. In his zeal to militarize civil society, Beck bestowed 3 self-designed merit awards to civilian honorees in the categories of hope, faith, and charity. In the Gospel, according to Beck, the awards are based on George Washington's Order of Merit Awards, which FDR redesigned into the modern Purple Heart, given to soldiers wounded in combat. Beck closed with a sermon in which he stated that, quote, "We all have to go to God boot camp so we can then lead the planet to safety." Amen. Bjorn Lomborg, self-styled global warming skeptic, famous for attacking climate scientists and the media for exaggerating the rate and effect of global warming, has also had a come-to-Jesus moment. Lomborg will announce in his new book that climate change is one of the most pressing issues facing citizens of the planet, and, quote, "a challenge humanity must confront." Lomborg calls for investing $100 billion annually in wind, wave, solar, and nuclear energy development. Lomborg calls for building better sea defenses and better global health care. It is his ideas on climate engineering, such as artificially whitening the clouds to better reflect solar radiation back into space, that sound like a job for God. In 1995 and into 1996, Newt Gingrich and the Republicans shut down the federal government and cost taxpayers $800 million. Gingrich once bragged that the reason he forced the shutdown was because then-President Clinton snubbed him by making him sit in the back of an airplane on a trip to Israel. Now, already eyeing potential electoral gains in November, Republicans can't wait to shut down the government again as a gambit to deny funding for the new health care bill. Eric Erickson, editor of the right-wing blog Red State, tweeted, quote, "I'm almost giddy thinking about a government shutdown next year. I cannot wait." Newt Gingrich himself at an Americans for Tax Reform breakfast stated, quote, "A simple majority can refuse to fund. So if you have Boehner as Speaker and Mitch McConnell as Majority Leader, all you have to do is not write into the appropriations bill the money." Fox News correspondent Dick Morris used to visit prostitutes to satisfy his toe-sucking habit, has a new fetish for shutting down the government. Eyeing the federal government as a giant foot with 310 million toes, Morris wants to bind it. Speaking on August 27th at an Americans for Prosperity Defending the Dream meeting, Morris put a foot in his mouth and said, quote, "Now there's going to be a government shutdown, just like in 95 and 96, but we're going to win it this time, and I'll be fighting on your side." Sam Stein, political reporter for the Huffington Post, points to a poll in Newsweek that shows 52% of Republicans agree with the statement that Barack Obama sympathizes with Islamic fundamentalists who want to impose Sharia law around the world. This is just another example of the knee-jerk schizophrenia of the political right, who can believe two totally opposite things at once. On one hand, Obama is a liberal who wants to teach sex education in the schools and allow women access to abortions. On the other hand, Obama is a secret Muslim who conspires to ban all of these things. For Uprising, I'm Chris Bennett, and this is The Right Hook, reality-based news and views.
Thanks, Chris. This is Uprising. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. A new book by scholar Gail Dines asserts that society's overconsumption of pornography and the ridiculous extremes of today's mainstream pornography have greatly undermined our ability to have meaningful sexual partnerships. In Pornland, How Porn Has Hijacked Our Sexuality, Professor Gail Dines traces the history of the porn industry to today's brutal fare that can be described as nothing less than the videotaped sexual assault of women. She also details how the porn industry is consumed with profits at the expense of women's degradation and the effects that this has on the men that view it. According to Dines, the pornographers did a kind of stealth attack on our culture, hijacking our sexuality and then selling it back to us, often in forms that look very little like sex, but a lot like cruelty. Gail Dines is a professor of sociology and women's studies at Wheelock College in Boston. She joins me in studio this morning. Welcome to Uprising.
Thank you for inviting me.
Thanks so much for joining us. Well, I have to say it was very difficult to read your book, and I had to skip parts where you describe mainstream pornography fare. This is not, you know, your father's Playboy or Penthouse magazines and videos. What we're seeing apparently in porn today and mainstream porn is completely bizarre. I mean, how do you handle it in your research?
Well, what's interesting is I, like the viewers, get desensitized over time. I mean, obviously, I couldn't have the visceral effect I had in the beginning to it. But I put those descriptions in because often people say to me, you know, why are you getting so upset by images of naked women? And what I want people to understand is that pornography now looks nothing like it did 10, 15 years ago, that it is now brutal and cruel and is absolutely based on the degradation of women. So this is why I walk people through the porn industry. Also, often anti-porn feminists are accused of picking the worst of the pornography. What I wanted to do was go into the mainstream pornography that the average 11-year-old would get once he put porn into Google.
Okay, well, since, of course, we are on public radio and these are public airwaves, we can't go very deeply into the details of what today's mainstream porn is. So I definitely encourage listeners to check out this book, particularly in your introduction and in your chapter two. But trace for our listeners the history, the evolution, if you will, of the pornography industry, both in terms of who has run it and its content.
Well, I mean, there's always been pornography floating around our culture, but I really put the pornography industry at 1953, starting then. Why? Because it was the first edition of Playboy, and this was the first time pornography really became industrialized, really became a product. Now, Hefner was very smart. He started in 53, post-Second World War America. And what this country needed to do was jumpstart the economy. Now, women were taught how to buy through television. There was nowhere to teach men. And remember, in the 50s, you had to teach people how to be consumers. I know it sounds bizarre today, but then, and so you, in order to teach people to be how to be consumers, you needed to show them what it was to buy products they didn't need. This is where Playboy was so successful. The advertising in Playboy was about telling men that if you consume at this level, then you will get the real prize, which is the women who look women in the magazine, or women who look like women in the magazine. So what he did, he didn't just commodify sexuality, he sexualized commodities, which is his brilliance. Also then in 1969, in the New York Times, there was an ad for Penthouse. And that was Penthouse trying to come in and dislodge Playboy from its number one position. And between 1969 and 1973, you had a war between Playboy and Penthouse to see who could be the most explicit. Now, in a way, Playboy lost the battle but won the war. And the reason it did that is we didn't go as explicit as Penthouse. And Penthouse went so explicit that a lot of the advertisers ran and were nervous about putting their images, their products in there. Now, during the battle between 69 and 73, they opened up the space for what was acceptable pornography. And it's no accident that in 1973, you saw the first edition of Hustler. And this absolutely pushed the limits of what could be mainstream hardcore pornography. So you had Playboy staking out the softcore, then you had Hustler staking out the hardcore. Those were, and I can't believe I say this, the good old days. Today, I mean, Hustler is mild compared to what you see in the mainstream pornography. The reason for this is that it's now so accessible.
Because of the internet.
Absolutely. The internet changed the industry. It made it accessible and it made it affordable. So remember, when the average age of first viewing pornography is 11, when the 11-year-old boy puts porn into Google, he's not looking at your father's Playboy. He's looking at a world of cruelty and a world of brutality. So what I ask in the book is, what are the long-term effects of bringing up boys on violent images when you think about pornography as being the main form of sex education in our society?
And I want to get to that question, but let's talk about the effects on women, because as the industry has changed, the women participating in that industry have gone from, you know, being photographed naked to now being literally brutalized, physically brutalized. What does the average female participant in the pornography industry, what does she go through in terms of just her physical degradation and physical health?
Well, I mean, if you watch pornography, you see that immediately. What you see is a woman being penetrated brutally, vaginally, anally, and orally. As that's happening, three men at one time, four men at one time, she's being called vile, hateful names. She's being sometimes slapped, sometimes her hair is pulled. Even the industry said that many women have a hard time being in the industry for more than 3 months. Why? Because of the brutalization of the body. Three months is off. This is what the article says in Adult Video News. Also, I've interviewed somebody who worked with AIM, which is the healthcare organization that takes care of the health of porn performers. And he was telling me just what happens to the bodies of these women. For example, he said one of the big things are anal prolapses, where literally the anuses drop out of the body and have to be sewn back in because of the brutal anal sex. He also talks about gonorrhea of the eye. And the latest thing, because you have something called, I don't know if I can say it on the radio.
Well, let's err on the side of caution.
where they put the penis into the anus and then into her mouth without washing. They're finding now that women are getting fecal bacterial infections in their mouth and throat. So, I mean, you've got a whole host of issues that women have to deal with in the porn industry. And what's interesting is nobody seems to be interested in these women. Instead, we get some, you know, ridiculous documentary saying, oh, you know, women like it, they choose it. Absolutely not. You know, you're looking at working class women who think they know what pornography is, who see Jenna Jameson and think they're going to be the next Jenna Jameson, when Jenna Jameson is one in 10,000. So, and really, Jenna Jameson has been an important recruitment tool because she suggests that this is what you can do if you go into pornography. And what do you know? You're 18, you think you know what you're going to get into, and then you get on the set and everything shifts and changes.
So what are the long-term effects on our sexuality as a result of this new era of brutal sexual assault that masquerades as pornography, both on men and women? Have there been studies?
Well, I mean, there's been studies for 30 years on men mainly. And what they find, and what I found in my interviews, is that the more pornography men watch, the less able they are to develop intimate relationships. Also, what's interesting is they lose interest in real women because the pornography is so hardcore. It's industrial strength sex. So anything less looks bland and boring. Also, the men think they should be performing like the men in pornography. They think their penises should look like that. They think they should be able to sexually perform for hours like the men do. What they don't realise is a lot of the men in pornography are on Viagra. That's why it is so possible. And they begin to really see women in terms of objects, not as somebody to have relationships with, but as somebody to do something to. Sex becomes something like making hate to a woman's body. They don't make love in pornography, they make hate.
Now, this is an aspect that gets debated over and over again. The pornographers and pro-pornography viewpoint is that what you see on your video screen is a fantasy, and that we're human beings that are capable of distinguishing between fantasy and reality, and we don't carry over what's in our fantasy to our real lives.
Well, I mean, it's very interesting we say that because, you know, as somebody who studies media and as somebody who's progressive, you know, when we study right-wing media, we don't say it's fantasy. We don't say, you know what, don't worry about Glenn Beck. Don't worry about Rush Limbaugh. People can distinguish. No, we understand that media shapes the way we think. It shapes our reality. It shapes our perceptions of the world. Pornography is one more form of media. It's a specific genre, which, by the way, is very powerful because it delivers messages to men's brains via the penis, which is an extremely powerful delivery system. So I think the idea that it's fantasy just it's not borne out given the studies that we know about how porn and how images in general affect people's view of the world.
I'm speaking with Gail Dines. She is a professor of sociology and women's studies at Wheelock College in Boston, and we're discussing her new book, Pornland: How Porn Has Hijacked Our Sexuality. She's currently in Los Angeles. Now, what about the profit motive here, and how has that changed? Because, of course, in the early days of Playboy and Penthouse, profit was the motive, and profit is the motive today as well. But how has the industry become so fiercely capitalistic that, in a way, it's almost a victim of itself?
Well, it's always been a capitalist industry. I mean, this is another thing that we don't want to think about, that pornography in reality is profit-driven. It's not about fantasy. It's not about play. It's not about fun. It's about money. When I went to the expo in Las Vegas, where the pornographers have their yearly expo, I interviewed a lot of pornographers. And what was amazing was what interested them is money. They don't talk sex. They talk money. They talk bulk mailing. They talk mass advertising. And what we forget when we talk about pornography is these are not fantasies created from nowhere that drop from the sky. These are fantasies created within a typical capitalist market. And what you see in pornography is a need to keep addressing that. Now, what's happened is that as more and more men are using pornography, they're becoming more bored and desensitized with it, which means that they want harder and harder stuff. And the pornography, because it's profit-driven, has to meet their needs. And what's interesting here is that pornography is actually, it's in a mess because they don't know what else to do, the pornographers. They've gone about as hardcore and as cruel as they can. They've done everything to women's bodies short of killing her. So the question is, what can they do next to keep an increasingly desensitized audience interested?
In an interesting way, pornography seems to almost be a metaphor for capitalism in general, right? Basically, unchecked growth. At some point, there's a limit. At some point, you hit a wall and you can't grow anymore. You can't go any further because you've gone as far as you can.
Well, I mean, that's the whole issue of capitalism in our society as well, is how much more can we continue given what's happening to the environment? But I mean, I would say that there's still room for the niche markets in pornography. And in my book, I talk about the specific niche markets. One of them is called interracial porn, which is black men and white women. Another one is what I call pseudo-child pornography, which is women who are 18, I'm pretty sure of that, but they look younger and they behave in a younger way. So what you have are men who are bored with adult women looking out for these pseudo-child porn sites. And I've interviewed child rapists, and some of them actually started looking, they didn't want to go to illegal child pornography, so they started with the legal so-called child pornography and then basically matured into child pornography. And for some of them, the distance between looking at child pornography and raping a child was 6 months.
6 months.
6 months.
Wow. What are the long-term effects on our society in general? Not necessarily just effects on the men that consume it, but how has pornography pornified, to use Pamela Paul's term, our culture?
Well, when I think we talk about a porn culture, we talk about the images and the messages and the ideologies of porn filtering down into mainstream media. I mean, you just have to turn on the television, flick through a magazine, go to the movies, and what you see is a pornographized version of the world. Now, I think this is true for women as well. If you go to Cosmopolitan, the places where women read, you'll often see articles about why you should have pornography to spice up your sex life. So what we're seeing is the pornographers have really taken control of the discourse around sexuality. There's nobody else who's getting any voice, who's coming up and saying, look, this is a particular type of sex that pornography is representing. It is brutality. It is based on the debasement of women. There's alternative ways of being sexual in our society that are not based on the debasement of women. But where do you hear this in the media? Because the media is increasingly becoming pornified. And you have the pornographers and their hacks in the media defining what our sexuality should be.
And the effects on young girls and boys, I mean, you mentioned the average age of a boy that views porn on the internet today is 11. Which is just, as a mother of a boy, it's just heartbreaking to me. Heartbreaking. So the effects on young children, both boys and then girls as well, who who see these pornified images on billboards and in magazines of what women are supposed to look like, are we, what are we doing to our children?
We're distorting their sexuality. We're forcing them into early sexuality as well, and we're turning their sexuality into a commodity so we can sell it, commodify it, and sell it back to them. I think one of the interesting things about how girls and young women are affected by the porn culture is that they date these men who themselves have been shaped by pornography. And what I found in my interviews with young women was that many of these men wanted to play out porn sex on their bodies. They wanted anal sex. They wanted all sorts of other things that they'd seen in pornography. And a lot of the women, they don't want to do it, but they don't have the vocabulary to express why they don't want to do it. Because everywhere they go in this society, they're told, if you don't do it, you're a prude. And what teenager or adolescent do you know wants to be defined as a prude? So the boys are pushing, nagging, cajoling girls into performing porn sex.
So, Gail, let's talk about the sort of feminist debate and where it stands over pornography. This is a long-standing debate. I'm sure you get asked this all the time. Where, you know, you've had this battle within feminist circles over pornography. On the one hand, feminists who point out that pornography is degrading to women and should be an issue taken up by feminists, and on the other hand, saying that those women who are in the pornography industry are empowered, or they're sex workers who ought to be respected like any other workers, and we shouldn't be prudes and we shouldn't be man haters or feminazis, which is a common term, which I'm sure you've been called. I have been called that. Do you see that conversation changing, given that the landscape of mainstream pornography has become so brutal now, or are we still blind to its brutality?
Well, this is a great question, because as pornography becomes more brutal, you would think that the conversation would get around to brutality and what happens to the women. And it's amazing, I think, those feminists who support the porn industry. They don't look at it as an industry. They look at it as a collection of women being empowered by the industry. Now, I'm not saying there's not some women who can't make this work for them. However, what I'm interested in is the macro, social and systematic effects of an industry, not of individuals working within it. And what I study is the mainstream industry, where women are not empowered. Women come and go. They enter the industry thinking they're going to be Jenna Jameson. They leave scarred. They leave emotionally affected by what's happened to them. And I think as feminists, we need to start with looking at the effects on women, both in the industry and outside the industry, because, as I said, these women are dating the men. I think also there's areas in feminism where they don't want to really see the reality of women's victim status, that we say women are no longer victims. Well, if you look at the level of violence against women in this society, you look at women struggling to feed their children, you look at women living in poverty, you know, we need to have feminism with politics. And what's happened, I think, is politics have been bled dry and bled out of feminism. So now you get this idea that, you know, we got what we wanted, or at least we can be empowered as individuals. I am sorry, but you cannot be empowered as individuals when women as a group are systematically discriminated against. And even if I'm okay, then my feminism was saying, you know what, I walk that distance for you because you're not okay. That's what sisterhood was about, not about looking at individuals and saying you're okay, so that's a sign that women are empowered.
Finally, Gail, where is the good news in all of this? Where are the, you know, where's the activism, and what are some avenues by which people can take action?
Well, there's a few places they can go where we've got resources online. My website, gaildines.com. Also, stoppornculture.com, which is an organisation that I co-founded, which has a list of resources. You can also download a 50-minute slideshow with a script and with images that you can give in your communities, you can give in your schools. It's being given across the country, in lots of different other countries as well. And you can join on, and we have conferences, and we actually train people how to give the slideshow as a way to start building a grassroots activist movement. And I often get letters from women all over the country telling me, you know, this has happened to me. Thank you for doing this work. I'm now joining your organization because my husband, my boyfriend, or whatever has been using pornography and I've been affected by it.
So all the slideshow can be downloaded at stoppornculture.com.
Yes.
GailDines.com is also another website, GailDines.com. Gail Dines, I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
Gail Dines is a professor of sociology and women's studies at Wheelock College in Boston, and we've been talking about her new book, Pornland, How Porn Has Hijacked Our Sexuality. For Sonali, Subversive Thought for the Day, I want to quote Liz Stanley and Sue Wise, who once said, Feminism directly confronts the idea that one person or set of people has the right to impose definitions of reality on others. And that's Liz Stanley and Sue Weiss. That's Sonali's subversive thought for the day. You've been listening to Uprising. Martina Steiner is our interim assistant producer. Teddy Robinson is our engineer. You can order a copy of today's show at 1-800-735-0230 or go to pacificaradioarchives.org. Join us at facebook.com/uprisingradio. Follow us at twitter.com/uprisingradio and drop us an email at mail@uprisingradio.org. Listen to the show online. Find links, local events, and other info at uprisingradio.org. I'm your host and producer, Sonali Kolhatkar. Thanks so much for listening. I'll see you tomorrow at 8. I tiptoe on a stiff rope bouncing. I tiptoe on a stiff rope bouncing.